From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, where we gather the highlights from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, you know the saying, as goes Wisconsin, so goes America?
Scott Walker's recall election is the second most important election in America this year.
We'll find out why Republican governors believe the Wisconsin recall race could change American politics for years to come. Also, why we humans have been biologically selected to like crispy stuff. Plus, how one out of two motels in America came to be owned by Indian immigrants.
They came to the U.S. and they fell into the hospitality industry by accident.
And later, remembering Richard Dawson and the Beach Boys at 50, Brian Wilson and Mike Love reunite.
Back in the studio, it sounded like it was 1965 again to me.
Also, Jack White, formerly of the White Stripes, on why he'll never make the same record twice.
Once people recognize you for anything, you're in a bind. Do you recreate what they like, or do you push forward and do something new?
That's all on this episode of Weekends and All Things Considered. Enjoy. In 2 days, voters in Wisconsin will decide whether or not to recall their governor, Republican Scott Walker. It's been one of the most expensive statewide races in American history, and the stakes in that election could have national implications for unions, for deficit hawks, for businesses, even for President Obama's reelection. And why many political leaders, Republican and Democrat, say that with the exception of the presidential race, the vote over whether to recall Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is the most important election this year. So important, it's drawn millions in outside money and some of the biggest political stars in the country, including former President Bill Clinton, who hit the campaign trail Friday for Tom Barrett, the Democratic mayor of Milwaukee, who is hoping to unseat Scott Walker.
If you don't show up and vote, we'll say, see, we got him now. We're finally going to break every union in America. We're going to break every government in America. We're going to stop worrying about the middle class. We don't give a rip whether poor people get to work their way into it. We got our way now. We got it all. Divide and conquer works. You tell them no.
So how did this all start to unravel for Scott Walker? He was elected governor in 2010 on a promise to rein in spending. Well, here's Wisconsin Public Radio's Sean Johnson with more.
People first started talking about the idea of a recall about a year and a half ago after Governor Scott Walker introduced his bill to curb public employee union bargaining rights. I remember in the first week of the massive protests that erupted here, you could hear chants of recall Walker. And back then, it seemed sort of, it was sort of fanciful to Democrats, but it slowly became a reality.
And over the winter, Wisconsin organizers, backed by unions, gathered more than 900,000 signatures on petitions that would eventually trigger this Tuesday's election.
And so here we find ourselves in a very abbreviated campaign in the middle of summer. And a campaign that everybody's watching.
Sean, here's what I don't get. Scott Walker did campaign on the promise of closing a $3.5 billion deficit, saying that he was going to ask public employees to basically give up part of their pensions. I mean, he said what he was going to do, so why was there this recall effort almost immediately after he was inaugurated?
He said he was going to balance the budget. He didn't provide a lot of details. He did say that he was going to look at pensions for public employees. He's been consistent on that, but he never talked about ending collective bargaining rights, and that was a shocker. And when he has described it to people candidly, he's referred to it as dropping the bomb.
So many people in Wisconsin felt like they were duped. I mean, Walker basically came in and said, by the way, we're going to end collective bargaining rights. And sorry, but that's the way it's going to be. And a lot of people said, wait a minute, you didn't say you were going to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was introduced on a Friday afternoon. The governor wanted the legislature to move on it pretty quickly the next week. And it didn't work out that way. We had our Senate Democrats left Wisconsin that held up the vote in the Senate because they didn't have a quorum, needed to pass it for a while. And the place just went nuts. We had tens of thousands of people at regular rallies, people living in the Capitol for a few weeks. That didn't calm down for a while.
Sean, explain how much money has poured into this campaign.
The dollar figures that were thrown around here are just astronomical in terms of Wisconsin's history. The old record for a governor's race in terms of money raised by a candidate was about $10 million, and that was set in 2010 by Governor Scott Walker. He's now raised $31 million in about a year and a half. You know, he just raised about $5 million in a month. raising money is not an issue for him right now, partly because when there's a recall going on, under our laws, the incumbent doesn't have to abide by our usual campaign finance contribution limits. Tom Barrett, his Democratic challenger, does have to abide by those limits. People can't give him more than $10,000 a pop. And he's raised about $4 million in the cycle. Normally, we'd be talking about that being record-setting pace, but he's getting killed in Wisconsin. He's getting killed on the airwaves because the governor has just destroyed all records.
So, Sean, I read that something like $62 million will be spent on this campaign by both sides, including the candidates and outside interest groups, for a recall election for a governor from Wisconsin, which is not California or New York. I mean, we're not talking hugely expensive media markets. Describe what the onslaught is like. I mean, are you just bombarded with ads on radio and TV and on billboards and newspapers all the time?
If you watch your local TV news, you know, in between the news, it's a pretty steady stream of candidate commercials, both from the governor, both from Democratic challenger Tom Barrett, and from the interest groups. It's just constant.
Hi, I'm Scott Walker.
With Tom Barrett as mayor, Milwaukee unemployment has gone up 28%.
Not voting on June 5th
is the same as voting for Scott Walker.
I got some bad news for Tom Barrett, but good news for Wisconsin.
They uncovered a secret email network set up by Walker's aides.
Help me oppose the recall. And let's use the foundation we've built to keep moving Wisconsin forward.
Presumably, the Democrats or some Democrats are worried that if Scott Walker survives this recall vote, it will look bad for President Obama and for Democrats.
It is definitely high-stakes politics. A recall something for a governor is something that's never happened here in Wisconsin. It's only the third nationally. So it's not a step that people have taken lightly. The Democrats really wanted to get Governor Scott Walker out now and not wait the full four-year terms. They felt strongly enough to take this extraordinary step. At the same time, if Walker wins, the recall would be the best thing that ever happened to him because he's immediately a national figure because of that, not only because he's the only governor to ever defeat a recall effort or to survive a recall effort, but because of the issue that he's running on. This is an issue that other governors have flirted with, and you know he's kind of taken it head on, and if he were to survive, it'd be big.
That's Wisconsin Public Radio's Sean Johnson. He covers state politics from Madison. Now, the latest polls show Scott Walker with a slight lead over Tom Barrett. And as you might have guessed, voters in Wisconsin are sharply divided. We sent producers out to two places in the state to talk to some of those voters, to Sussex, a heavily Republican suburb outside Milwaukee, and to Madison, a Democratic stronghold. First to Madison now, where anti-Walker activists have been gathered on the steps of the State House all week.
My name is Marie Martini. Our state is being destroyed. I'm a grandmother. My grandchildren are seventh generation Wisconsin people, and I'm not giving them the state that I had. And I'm an educator. My students don't have enough food. In America? In Wisconsin? Kids are hungry? Kids are living out of a car? It's shameful. And if something doesn't happen, we'll be destroyed. We'll go to the very rich and the very poor, and there won't be middle class anymore.
Catherine Capilaro. Well, I think that Scott Walker has been able to, and with the Republican majority, has been able to really undo 50 years of labor peace here in Wisconsin, in the state that pioneered collective bargaining. And it's not just about collective bargaining. I've got kids in the schools that are suffering right now from budget cuts. And I just think that our state is not ready to be given away to powerful corporate interests.
Voices of Wisconsin voters in Madison, now to Sussex, outside the town post office, where almost everyone seemed to back the governor.
Grizz, last name is Straub, but Walker's doing a damn good job. Best thing he's done, keep the taxes the same and lower them. And there is jobs available, people just got to go get them. The jobs are there, but you still, to keep working, we had to take a pay cut. Which my boss was, I said, that's fine. As long as I still got a job, I don't care. I'll take a 5% discount, no big deal. Instead of all these guys paying, giving them all these fancy bonuses for what? What do I get? Nothing. Why should I pay for somebody else's retirement plan when I got to pay for my own?
I'm Chris Tuhalski. It's just not quite fair that while other people are doing more and giving more, there's those that have these pensions that pretty much make them very comfortable. And some of us work and work and work, and we just don't have that. And let's use teachers, for example. Some of the teachers in the schools are great, deserve what they're getting, and some of them just plain stink. And they have a union backing them no matter what they do. They stay in their jobs, and they shouldn't be there. So those are a couple of the reasons.
Voices of Wisconsin voters in Sussex, just outside Milwaukee. Now, if Scott Walker survives the recall, Republican governors around the country have said it will be a turning point, a referendum in a sense, on whether they too can confront public sector unions and make huge spending cuts. We asked Bruce Colburn, a leader with the Wisconsin branch of the Service Employees International Union, about what Walker's victory will mean for unions in the state and even nationally.
It'll hurt. I mean, one of the first things Scott Walker did when he talked about that he's going to do something about state workers, he included workers from our University of Wisconsin World Class Hospital, which had nothing to do with the state. He did away with the rights to bargain of home care workers who only make $8 or $9 an hour, who have nothing to do really with the state, aren't even state workers. So certainly it will be a blow, but we're determined that whatever we have to rebuild, we will rebuild.
So we just heard from voters in Wisconsin, but in fact, the race has become a national story, a story that could mark a turning point for public sector unions and for deficit hawks. And Scott Walker's survival has become a rallying cry for Republican leaders across the country. South Carolina's Governor Nikki Haley has hit the stump.
All eyes across our country are on Wisconsin.
Louisiana's Governor Bobby Jindal's come through the state.
He has been a great leader for Wisconsin. He's been a great leader for America.
So has Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey and one of the most popular Republicans in the country.
When tens of thousands of people crowded your state house, disrupted your government, and tried to scare Scott Walker stood with you.
Virginia's Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli has asked his backers to donate to Scott Walker's campaign. Cuccinelli is a rising star in the Republican Party. He's running for governor next year, and right now he holds a significant lead in the polls. And on Tuesday, Ken Cuccinelli will be watching Wisconsin closer, quite possibly closer, than he ever has before.
Scott Walker's recall election is the second most important election in America this year. The only one more important is the presidential election in November. Because we face some very severe, especially financial challenges in government at every level right now, that if Scott Walker can't implement the kind of changes he has and survive the electoral storm that has come, the self-preservation instincts of politicians are going to overwhelm the need to solve our problems. And that would be a sad thing for America.
I mean, essentially what you're saying is that if he doesn't survive, other governors won't feel emboldened to take on public employee unions. If he does win, governors around the country who want to take on unions will?
You're focusing in just on unions, but you also have pension problems in states. At the federal level, we have entitlement reform. It's related to all of these types of problems because the theme is the same. We have to make painful changes. We're going to have less of this service and that service in order to fund our pensions, in order to make sure that they're actuarially sound, in order to make sure that our country doesn't go bankrupt. It is very important for Scott Walker to win this election, not just for Wisconsin, but for America.
Attorney General Cuccinelli, you, of course, are going to be running for governor of Virginia next year. If Scott Walker survives this recall, how might that influence your role if you win as governor? How might that influence the way you carry out your job?
Well, I think I'm probably already in the category of people who campaign very clearly on what they want to do and then attempt to pursue it. So in terms of the bluntness factor, I'm already there, but nobody does anything alone, including Governor Walker. I mean, he needed allies in his legislature, and I'll need allies in my legislature if I'm able to get elected governor in Virginia. And you need a team, and often, and ideally, usually, that would be a bipartisan team. This message that I've talked about isn't just for Republicans. It's about the financial survival, stable financial survival of our state governments and of our federal government. That's all wrapped up in Governor Walker's recall election. And again, that's why it's so important that he win.
That's Virginia's Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli. He's running for governor of the state next year. Now, President Obama has been notably absent from the Wisconsin fight. He's endorsed Walker's opponent, Tom Barrett, but otherwise he's been quiet. But the White House is watching Wisconsin closely because in many ways, it's a trial run for the presidential race. Big money coming in from outside groups and a referendum on spending. Here's the analogy NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson makes.
I think it's like the Spanish Civil War was to World War II, where both sides got to try out their weapons. This is going to be seen as a test case for the power and clout of the super PACs. Walker's raised tremendous amounts of outside money, which he's allowed to do under the law, about $30 million. So if he wins, I think the message will be the super PACs have a tremendous advantage. If he loses, I think it will mean even more. I think it will be a huge boost to the Democrats, to the labor movement, and it'll mean that the super PACs can't buy everything. Mm.
If Scott Walker survives this recall, what does it mean for President Obama in Wisconsin in the fall? Does it mean anything?
If you talk to people at the White House, they say it means nothing at all. People who turn out in the primary are not the same as the people who will turn out in November. Obviously, you have a much bigger electorate in a presidential race. President Obama won Wisconsin by a pretty healthy margin in 2008. Granted, Democrats in the past had won it by smaller margins, and of course, Republicans roared back in 2010 to sweep Wisconsin. But the polls show that President Obama still has a lead there. It still is on most people's list of battleground states. The Republicans believe that if Walker wins, Wisconsin automatically becomes a gettable state for Mitt Romney. And I think that one practical effect of the recall, regardless of whether Walker wins or loses, is that it's helped the Republicans on the ground in Wisconsin. They didn't have much in the way of voter lists and a get-out-the-vote turnout operation before this. They do now.
You combine that strategy with very bad jobless figures this past week, and things are not looking good for President Obama.
They're really not. And when you think about this election, which was and is tied, it's a dead heat, and then you think about all of the external factors that could affect it, the economy, jobless rate, Europe, Wisconsin recall, Supreme Court health care decision, put them all on a list. You can only think of things that will affect this race badly for the president. You can't see any potential extraneous events that will make it better for him. So, yes, I would say the president is definitely the underdog in this race. The jobs numbers didn't help him. And I don't think that a victory for Scott Walker on Tuesday will help him either.
That's NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson on the Wisconsin recall vote and its national implications. Mara, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy.
Okay, so go ahead and think of every food you can that's crispy. French fries, for example. Of course, potato chips. Anything tempura. Now, here's a question. Even though all that stuff is pretty bad for you, why is it all so good? And why, to quote Chef Mario Batali, does the word crispy sell more food than almost any other single adjective? Well, that's a question that John Allen, an anthropologist at the University of Southern California, poses in his new book. And John Allen, I am, of course, eating some potato chips.
Yes, you are.
These are the Utz, these are the Utz brand potato chips, common here in the Mid-Atlantic. They are delicious, I must admit. I don't eat them often. I've got two children. I don't, you know, want to set a good example, but they are good. And why is that? Why are they so good?
Well,
pardon me.
Well, the potato chip.
Go ahead.
The potato chip is very crunchy and crispy. So if we go back and look at all these sort of why crispy appeals, we can start, 60 million years ago, when primates first started to separate themselves from other kind of mammals, probably one of the reasons that they did so is that those little kind of primates ate a lot of insects. Not going back so far, a lot of vegetable plant material is also crispy, especially if it's fresh, and so it's a sign of freshness. We have very more hardwired appeal for salty, sugar, maybe fat, that's sort of debated, and a flavor called umami, which is very savory. We don't have a crispy detector, but yet the crispiness appeals to us.
See, but how much of that is about the sound?
Well, I think the sound, this gets at a sort of more individual level of sensory habituation. If you eat a lot of the same food at one sitting, you start to stop tasting it so well. And, people like Thomas Keller, who have these very expensive, fancy restaurants, they serve all sorts, many, many small courses. And part of it is to avoid that habituation. But when you add crispiness to it, you can sit there and munch away. I had a big bowl of popcorn. I was watching some basketball game a week or two ago, and I just kept munching away at it.
Yeah, you can't
stop. I realized I kind of enjoyed that crunch, crunch, crunch. I think, again, that's another, in terms especially in that sort of Batali comment about putting it on a restaurant menu.
Yeah.
Or hearing it said.
Crispy.
Crispy. And it's true. It's like a lot of functional imaging studies. If you visualize certain activities in your brain, then you can do a scan and you can see that certain parts of the brain are already lighting up. So when you say crispy, your mouth is already moving. You're activating that whole system. So I think onomatopoetics, especially in that sort of menu sense, gets you going and makes it almost like, oh, it's already almost there.
That's John Allen. He's a research scientist at the University of Southern California. He writes about why we like all kinds of foods in addition to crispy ones in his new book, The Omnivorous Mind. John Allen, thanks.
No problem.
Oh, before you go, what's up with Krispy Kreme? That's not crispy.
No, I've always been at it, and cream is spelled wrong, so I'm very, they have K.
Crunchy, crunchy, kind of potato chips, crunch. Crunchy, crunchy, a crunch, crunch, crunch. I don't want no lunch. All I want is potato chips.
Here are three remarkable facts about motels in America. At least one out of two motels are now owned by Indian Americans. And out of those Indian-owned motels, 70% are owned by Gujaratis, people with roots in the western Indian state of Gujarat. And of those Gujaratis, three-fourths share the last name Patel. It spawned a name for these overnight establishments, Patel Motels. Pavan Dhingra writes about this incredible story in his new book. It's called Life Behind the Lobby, about how Gujaratis came to dominate the motel industry in America.
They're a population that prized themselves on autonomous professions, working for themselves. So they were farmers back in Gujarat before they came to the U.S. So they were looking to own their own business. Hmm. They didn't have to be motels. In fact, they knew nothing about motels. There are very few motels in India. Someone told me this, that there's more motels in Florida than all of India.
What?
So we're not talking about something indigenous that they were looking for. And they fell into the hospitality industry by accident. And this is at a time in the 40s and 50s when these residential hotels were seen as places that cater to a down-and-out population, where there's going to be drugs and alcohol, whatever else going on. European Americans and Japanese Americans who ran those hotels were looking to get out. Japanese Americans were interned. But even Frenchmen and other European Americans who had been running them, it's not a lot of money to be made. Their kids didn't want to take them over, so no one else wanted to buy these.
You write how once immigrants from India established themselves with, you know, in the sort of the motel industry, they began to encourage and help family members come to the U.S. and do the same. I mean, as you say, in Gujarat, many people came from farming backgrounds, agricultural backgrounds, to a completely different world. And also, many of these folks were willing to move to very rural places, places that were predominantly white, had probably never really ever met immigrants or people from certainly from India.
Exactly. And so what happens is, let's say I own a motel in Maryland somewhere, and I bring my family in to help run it. Right? And they're happy to come over. Because they know that eventually, if not for themselves, at least for their children, they feel there's more opportunities in the U.S. than there is in India. And then I come and I live inside my relative's motel in Maryland. After 5-6 years, there's a place that opens up in Arizona or Oklahoma or wherever else. I'll buy that place. I'm looking for the best deal. And I would ask people all the time, why would you want to move to, you know, the middle of nowhere someplace? So removed from anyone else you know. There's no other family members. There's no Indian restaurant around. There's no temple. There's nothing. And they'd say, in a sense, I didn't move from India to the U.S. all that way to then not move another 1,000 miles to get a better deal, to get the motel I came here for.
I want to ask you about the next generations, because you write about, allude to this in the book, when you talk about other ethnic groups and immigrant groups, Greek Americans and diners and Jewish Americans and the textile industry, Korean Americans and the convenience stores. More often than not, their children go on to do other things. And you write, in the case of motels, very often the children of the Indian immigrants who were born in America decide to do it themselves, to run motels or to take over the motel.
Right. And many of them say, I hated living in the motel. I was so eager to get out of it. I swore I'll never go back to it. And they got jobs, you know, in engineering firms or whatever it is.
Medical schools,
whatever it could be. And they say, here I am working this job, and I have a boss, and that boss has a boss, and that boss has a boss. And I see my dad working fewer hours than I am, making more money than me.
Wow.
Why am I doing this? So unlike a lot of the other businesses that you mentioned, a diner or a liquor store or a grocery store, the motel industry has multiple levels. So there's the independent places that are relatively inexpensive. There's franchise, low-level franchise places. And there's mid-level, high-level, even major hotel chains. So the children who grew up in the motels and go back in the industry, they typically enter at the hotel at a higher level than their parents were. So they feel like they're stepping up, not reproducing, not doing the same thing their parents did. They moved forward, but they still have the same, all the resources, all the knowledge that they can draw from because they're still in the same industry. It's the best of both worlds for them.
I'm speaking with Pavan Dhingra. He's written a new book. It's called Life Behind the Lobby. It tells the story of how Indian immigrants came to dominate the motel industry here in the United States. Pavan, you write about the issue of discrimination, racial discrimination, and about how in some cases, you write, motel owners go quite far in trying to hide the fact that they own the hotel. You describe this idea of whitening the lobby of the hotel. What does that mean?
It's not universal, but it does happen. It's definitely a trend, which is to portray the motel to the customer as not being ethnically touched. So what they would do is oftentimes hire non-Indian desk clerks to work the afternoon shift when most people check in, who the customer would not look at and have any kind of negative reaction towards. So many of the motels, the family who runs the motel lives in the motel, and their home actually can be connected to the lobby. So behind the check-in desk of your motel is their apartment. You don't see it, it's behind a wall, but that's where they live. They come in through a side door into the lobby from their apartment behind the check-in desk. And so their kitchens are back there. And they had to be conscious of what time they cooked their Indian food so that it didn't create the scent of Indian food in the lobby during times when customers may come in and smell it, because that would just put people off. And someone said to me, you know, I walked into a motel and there was someone who was French at the front desk. And it was really kind of attractive to have this French accent and kind of high culture notion to the motel. So in other words, someone being foreign or being different is not always bad. We may like that in some ways. It may add to our sense of what we're paying for. But for the Indian food or Indian bodies, did not always carry that implications.
In the coming decades, do you see Indian-American hotel owners running high-end hotel chains? Is that where this is headed?
Yeah, I think so. It's a matter of time. And what's interesting, in addition to that, is there'll also still be Indians running the mom-and-pop places at the same time. And so as one Indian sells his, let's say, Holiday Inn and buys something even better, he'll sell it to another Indian. And I don't see that many other ethnic groups getting into the industry, joining Indians to the same rate.
That's Pavan Dhingra. He's the author of a new book. It's called Life Behind the Lobby, Indian American Motel Owners and the American Dream. Pavan, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
If you're hearing this, it must be summertime. For 50 years, the Beach Boys have provided the soundtrack to summer. But after the success of their now legendary 1966 record, Pet Sounds, the band began to splinter. Mental health issues plagued Brian Wilson, and his involvement waned while other members carried on the Beach Boys' name, not without frequent legal battles. The band also suffered the deaths of Brian Wilson's brothers, Dennis and Carl. But now, founding members Mike Love and Brian Wilson have gathered all the surviving original Beach Boys to celebrate their 50th anniversary with a brand new album, their first together in over two decades.
We've got beaches in mind. Man, it's been too much time.
The new record is called That's Why God Made the Radio. Mike Love says it all started during rehearsals last year to re-record one of their old hits from 1969.
When we were in the studio doing Do It Again at Capitol Records, Brian had some stuff that he showed us, and we went to the piano, and then we did some vocal parts to it and, added to what he had already started. And so it was really cool because you could hear that knack for chord progressions and vocal arrangements Brian's always had. Mm-hmm. It was just like there was never any lapse in time, really.
How about for you, Brian? What were those rehearsals like when you got back?
It was nuts.
Yeah.
We had Mike's band leader, Scott, is a slave driver.
He is, but that's cool. He's really into
every... slave driver.
He's into every single note and chord and everything.
He wants it perfect.
I mean, obviously your voices have matured. They're different. And so how do you think about taking your voices now, you know, Beach Boys 50 years later?
I don't think we've changed that much. I mean, we all have the ranges in which we sound the best. In fact, back in the studio, it sounded like it was 1965 again to me.
Sometimes I realize my days are getting on. Sometimes I realize it's time to move along. And I wanna go home.
I'm speaking with Brian Wilson and Mike Love of the Beach Boys. Our new record is called That's Why God Made the Radio. We've been speaking, of course, about one kind of harmony, and I want to ask about the other kind of harmony. Brian, you've, of course, spent a lot of time away from the Beach Boys. There were many tough years and disputes between the members of the band. Talk about the band today. I mean, is there harmony within the Beach Boys now, Mike and
of
Brian?
Of course there is, of course. Yeah. You know, we've had 50 years practice.
Yeah.
Not just in music, but as being guys, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Practice being a guy, you know.
Well, Brian and I go back to childhood together. The first time I remember him singing was on Grandma Wilson's lap singing Danny Boy and Christmas carols and singing doo-wop and Everly Brothers together. So we go way back. And so although there might have been separation for periods of time or might have been getting hung up on a dispute over something, those things are way in the past. And right now, we're in the moment. We're doing some great music together. We're doing fantastic concerts. I mean, this public has responded amazingly to seeing us all together.
Do you sometimes think, God, why did we waste our time ever fighting?
Yeah, I do. I think there are definite mistakes made because of ego and whatever reasons, and I just wasn't thinking clearly enough. And so I'm glad all that stuff is in the past, and we're on the same page together, harmony-wise. So we're all about harmony these days, both individually and musically.
There are a lot of references on this record to nostalgia, to sort of remembering the good old days and wishing it could be that way again. Did you go into writing with that theme in mind?
Brian got the ball rolling with the tracks, and what I thought about is the nostalgia part and whatever contributions I made. It definitely influenced me in writing these songs, being back together and maybe not having been together for a while.
The good times never have to end, and now's the time to let them happen again. We can have ourselves a blast. Good times, they aren't only in the past.
Brian, when you're on stage with your bandmates, are there moments where you are a bit emotional, just, you know, being there and being back? And
yeah, when they fix up a video of Carl and Dennis singing on the screen, we do Dennis' song Forever, and Carl goes, does God Only Knows? And it's very a sentimental experience.
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah, but it's really great, though, to include Dennis and Carl on this tour.
They're up on a huge screen behind us, up against the wall.
So it is an emotional experience. There's no doubt about that.
I may not always love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you.
How do you guys respond when you hear many, many modern bands and acts say, Pet Sounds the greatest record ever made?
Not the greatest. One of the greatest, though. It was a special album, it really was.
What was the greatest ever made?
Oh, I would have to say Sail Away by Randy Newman.
Wow.
Wow.
But of course, I don't know if anyone agrees.
Pet Sounds has been a favorite of a lot of people. In fact, Paul McCartney once said something about God Only Knows being the perfect song or the best song ever made or something.
I mean, apparently when John Lennon heard it, they were terrified about releasing Sgt. Pepper's, right?
Because I don't know about terrified. I think there was a mutual admiration society going on there back in 65, 66.
They say I got brains, but they ain't doing me no good. I wish they could.
A lot has been made, you know, over the years of the differences that the two of you have had. But what do you share? What do Mike Love and Brian Wilson share?
50 years of music.
Make that's it 70.
That's a lot of years to be together.
Yeah.
And we still love each other. And that's
right.
And we're about to do another concert tonight.
Well, Mike Love and Brian Wilson are two of the founding members of the Beach Boys. They've reunited for a new record. It's called That's Why God Made the Radio. Mike Love, Brian Wilson, thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.
You can hear a few tracks from the Beach Boys' new record at our website, nprmusic.org. Now to some sad news.
It's time for The Family Feud, introducing the Johnson family.
Wendy. The actor and original host of Family Feud has died.
And now, here is the star of The Family Feud, Richard Dawson.
Richard Dawson hosted the show for nearly 10 years, up till 1985.
Help me welcome the champs, the Johnson family.
He was an affable showman. He was known for kissing his female contestants.
Here we go.
Okay.
Good luck. Oh, this is for luck.
Oh, thank you.
He said in an interview years later, he began kissing contestants after a nervous young girl clammed up on the show on the question, name a green vegetable you can eat raw.
I said, I'm going to do something that my mom would do to me whenever I had a problem of any kind. And I went like this and I kissed her on the cheek. I said, that's for luck. And she said, asparagus.
It worked sometimes.
15 seconds, please. During what months of pregnancy does a woman begin to look pregnant?
September.
Something. Oh.
Dawson was also known for his role as Corporal Newkirk on the CBS comedy Hogan's Heroes. He died Saturday night in Los Angeles after battling cancer. He was 79.
During what months of... Hold the clock. During what... I'm sorry, Don, because it is important. There's money involved.
Time now for music and someone who took an unlikely road to rock stardom.
I'm gonna fight them all. A seven nation army couldn't hold me back.
Jack White grew up the youngest of 10 children in a working class home in Detroit. He climbed his way up through the ranks of the upholstery business until he decided to give rock and roll a try. He formed a two-piece band with his ex-wife Meg, and they passed themselves off as brother and sister. Wearing only red, white, and black, the White Stripes played blues music with punk ferocity, and somehow the White Stripes became a huge hit.
And a message coming from my eyes says, leave it alone.
Jack White dissolved the White Stripes last year. Now he's just released his first solo album, and it immediately shot to number one. It's called Blunderbuss.
I won't let love disrupt, corrupt, or interrupt me. Yeah, I won't let love disrupt, corrupt, or interrupt me anymore.
Jack White's fans have been poring over the album's lyrics, looking for insights into his psyche. He says, don't bother. The songs are not autobiographical. They're just characters. So when we spoke a few days ago, I asked Jack White about another Detroit native who speaks through characters.
The novelist Jeffrey Eugenides has written as a man and has written from a woman's perspective. Have you ever done that?
All the time. Oh, yeah, all the time. The he's and she's and I's are sort of all arbitrary. You know, some of them fall in the blues context of just man versus the world or man versus woman or something like that. But they don't really have anything to do with male or female. I mean, you should always think of it as yourself when you're a listener to a song, if you can try to get into the song and relate to it in some way.
When you sit down to write a song, have you already kind of sketched out
a character in your mind? I mean, do you walk around with a notepad and think, this could be a good character, somebody to think about when I'm writing a song? Or does that character kind of just form as you're writing the song?
It usually forms for me because it becomes my problem. Like, what do I do now with this person? And you take a song, like on the record, I guess I should go to sleep. You know, mm-hmm. I just played a chord and said the first line I said was,
I guess I should go to sleep.
And now I have to find a reason why this person should go to sleep. What's wrong? You know, is this a positive thing or a negative thing? And trying to look at it from different angles and what this character could possibly go through to get to the point where he would say this out loud.
Well, I guess I'll take off my shoes, head upstairs, and then watch the news. That's another way to lose these walking blues. I guess I'll take off my shoes.
When you finish this record, do you listen to it and say, I just made a great record? I mean, are you really proud of this?
It's very tough. I always wanted to, when I was younger, ask somebody who was an artist or a songwriter, musician, about pride. I wanted to ask when pride was appropriate. You know, I didn't, it always felt wrong, you know, trying to avoid any kind of ego trips or getting a buzz for the wrong reasons. I try not to listen to any other music when I'm writing, and when it's finished, I have to listen to it a few times. And it's best to listen to it with someone else in the room or in the car, usually a girl for me. It always feels like there's some kind of honesty that comes out. That's when I start to know that I got somewhere. I connected, even if it was only for a few seconds in each song, got someplace new that I haven't been before. And when you feel an ounce of it, you have to let yourself feel some tiny bit of pride or something. I don't know what. It's very, very confusing. Probably be my first question to God if we ever meet.
But don't get out of your chair or put a bow in your hair. You might be making a stare, so leave the care to the poor.
I'm speaking with Jack White, formerly of the White Stripes. His new record is called Blunderbuss. Jack, I want to ask you about your upbringing. For people who don't know, you were the youngest of 10 kids in a very obviously large Catholic family in a working class part of Detroit. Both your folks worked for the diocese. When you were a kid, what did you think you would become?
I didn't know. For a long time, I thought about the Air Force or the Marines. And then when I got to be, you know, 12, 13, I started to think about being a priest. And I got accepted at a seminary for a minute, and that was an idea in my head. But then I just decided at the last second to go to public school in Detroit. It definitely took me down a different road. And I started working in an upholstery shop and eventually opened my own place, and it was turned on to all different kinds of music through all that experience.
Do you get a chance to go back to Detroit? I know you don't live in Detroit. You now live in Nashville.
Yeah.
But you're connected, deeply connected to that city.
Sure.
Do you get to go back?
Yeah, I was just there last week. We played across the street from where I went to high school. We played at the Masonic Temple.
Do you get to go back and be a regular person there?
No, I don't think so. I think that that's something I gave up or was taken away or I gave it away or I don't know what, but it doesn't, it's I'm just a visitor.
How do you feel about celebrity?
I don't know it too much, and it's not fun. It's not interesting. It's distracting because it's not truth anymore. If someone comes up to you and says on the street, "I love that movie you were in, that record you did," you don't know if it's true or if they just recognized you and they wouldn't even like you before they saw you 2 seconds ago. They just recognize you and they get a buzz or something, you know. So you can't take it as truth. You can only take it as, oh, thank you, and you move on. Like I get jealous of Broadway performers and Vegas performers. Like sometimes I think they have a clear understanding of what people like and why they like it and what hits and what doesn't, what gets a laugh, what gets a standing ovation.
It sounds like you're saying people are not honest with you.
Well, who was it? Marlon Brando said, you know, once you become famous, you never meet anybody ever again. And that might be true. You know, Dylan says, you know, he can look through a window in a restaurant and everything's great, and once he walks into the restaurant, it's all destroyed.
I lift up my head and I wonder just who it is calling, calling my name now. I trip on my way and I'm blunder, my head falling under, a blanket of shame.
On the track On and On and On, you sing, "The people around me won't let me become what I need to.
Become what I need to, they want me the same. I look at myself and I want to just cover my eyes and give myself a new name."
Is this something that you feel about your music that people want Jack White to make the last Jack White record again?
I think you're always in it. Once people recognize you for anything, you're in a bind. Do you recreate what they like, or do you push forward and do something new? I was reading something. Somebody sent me this hilarious thing from an old English newspaper about Sgt. Pepper's, the week Sgt. Pepper came out, and it was different people's reviews of it. And, you know, people were just, other artists saying, I won't listen to it. I refuse to buy it. And I didn't realize people didn't dig that record when it came out. And that's really funny. I mean, what did they want the Beatles to do, for goodness sakes? You know, they wanted them to rewrite, you know, A Hard Day's Night or something. On and on, on and on, on and on,
on and on.
Jack White, I want to talk about authenticity, because you've talked a lot about it in the past, and in ways that seem to suggest that you still feel you have something to prove. And I wonder why part of you feels that way.
Because I think that we're obsessed with it. I think especially white culture in America and England, too, are obsessed with it. Because you understand, like, when we had the White Stripes, we came out, White Stripes were playing blues music, in our opinion, in our minds. And there's this whole contingent of sort of Stratocaster, white boy blues world out there that think if you didn't wear jeans and a T-shirt on stage, you weren't real. You know, so it was our obvious thing to wear. We're only going to wear red, white, and black, and the biggest finger to anybody who thinks that is just the most ridiculous thing in the world. You know, Howlin' Wolf didn't do that. Robert Johnson didn't do that.
Do you feel like when it comes to the idea of authenticity, you have spent a lot of time thinking about it because the music you're inspired by is music that comes from black America?
Yeah. Well, I'm already playing music that's not mine. I'm a white kid from the 70s from Detroit, from the North, and I'm obsessed with the music of the South, usually had been invented and designed by African Americans. So I'm already in a zone that is not what you consider natural. Because we're not playing house music with synthesizers and drum machines, where it would have been off the map. Nobody would even mention it.
People would have said he's from Detroit. Of course he plays that.
Of course, yeah. Detroit, they invented techno. He should be playing techno. That makes perfect sense. Mm. It's almost like, now they say, like, oh, you live in Nashville, so you must be making country records now. Like, it's like, no, if I move to Seattle, it doesn't mean I'm going to join a grunge band. There's a lot of funny notions, and I've always had fun making fun of them and also living inside of them at the same time.
Well, Jack White, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Jack White's latest solo album is called Blunderbuss. You can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. The week ending June 3rd, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered. Our program is directed this week by Walter Ray Watson. Daniel Shukin is our engineer. Our production staff includes Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Amy Held, and Phil Harrell. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the program on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.